One of the great things about being at UC Santa Barbara is having these fantastic general relativists, and in particular, we're bringing in a different set of tools and perspectives. And in particular, I'm happy that I've gotten to write 5 papers with Gary. And along the way, I figured out that what Gary's secret is very simple. He just knows every solution to Einstein's equations. And if you have a new problem, he'll take one of his solutions, double wick rotate, boost, and there you are. Although a few years ago, he decided that knowing all the analytic solutions weren't enough, and as you know, he's proceeded to corner the market on numerical solutions as well. Now, I've had a lot of discussions with people before this, and everybody's saying, you know, there's no good stories about Gary. He's just so perfect. But, you know, having written so many papers with him, I've seen another side. And I think it was like our 2nd paper together, he sent me a draft back, and as I read it, I saw he had misspelled a couple of words. And not just once, but like several times. So I mean, you're shocked too, right? I mean, this was not... this was not the Gary I thought I knew. But he has other foibles. If he thinks that you're disrespecting general relativity, he'll get a little hot under the collar. You know, if you call him a string theorist, or if you suggest that maybe the equivalence principle breaks down at the horizon of a black hole, you know, you can see him getting a little red. But in spite of these character flaws, you know, Gary has helped to build a wonderful atmosphere here, and I look forward to many more years of working with you. Okay, so on to our session. We have, in this session, 2 leading string theorists speaking. So let's proceed with Bob Wald and his talk.
Thank you. So is this microphone working? Yeah, it sounds like it is. So Gary Horowitz arrived at Chicago to start as a beginning graduate student in 1976, which is exactly when I joined the faculty there, although I'd been there a couple of years as a postdoc. And Gary immediately began collaborating with Bob Geroch and with me. I think with each of us must have written at least 2 or 3 papers, I know with me that number. And within 3 short years, because that's all Gary took to get his PhD, you know, with this collaboration, I mean, Gary emerged with the characteristics that we, you know of him very well, including a very deep knowledge of mathematical relativity, excellent taste and judgment in choosing, problems, and a very clear and elegant writing style. Now, in interest of completeness, I should maybe add that Gary had all of these characteristics when he entered Chicago. But I think that shows the critical and key role that the Chicago Relativity Group played in his development, because we did not ruin him. Gary came in with those characteristics, and he still had them when he left. And, I mean, imagine if it were otherwise. I mean, at that early stage in his career, he probably would have never recovered, and none of us would be here today to celebrate his accomplishments. So what I wanted to tell you about today, I mean, does not have anything to do with work I did with Gary or really with Gary's work, but I thought this would be the best topic to be talking about here in a, you know, rather mixed audience. Now, I mean, if this talk were being given 45 years ago, this would perhaps seem incredibly random. I mean, maybe I'll spend 10 minutes each on black holes, then 10 minutes on thermodynamics and Lagrangians. Well, for the last 40 years, it's certainly been well understood that there's a very deep connection between black holes and thermodynamics. What I want to emphasize in this talk is that Lagrangians really play a very deep role, a role that I don't fully really understand myself in this connection, and also show you that, well, Lagrangians well, are an extremely powerful tool for doing things. Now, 25 years ago, I would have thought that, at least for classical physics, they certainly do some other things in quantum physics, the main use of a Lagrangian is that it's a great mnemonic device. If you have some complicated equations of motion, it's much easier to remember the Lagrangian, and then you can derive the Euler-Lagrange equations quietly in a corner if you need to. Much easier to memorize that than memorize the full equations of motion. Now, by then I had already memorized Einstein's equation, so I didn't really think Lagrangians for general relativity were going to be useful for anything. If one asks people or hears people talk about Lagrangians, I mean, they're often talked about in a way that you really need them to have good equations of motion or have well-posed equations. There's, as far as I know, no truth at all to this. I mean, you can have good equations without a Lagrangian, and you can have bad equations with a Lagrangian. But Lagrangians, as I've learned, I mean, are incredibly useful. And it's really because they provide some vitally important auxiliary structure to the theory. I mean, specifically, conservation laws and association of conservation laws with symmetries that are, well, I think quite vitally important in general, but they're really important to understand this structure in understanding the thermodynamic properties of classical black holes, even though a priori one wouldn't have thought this has anything to do with it. So that's what I want to show you in this talk, and I'll be giving a few what I would consider to be tips on using Lagrangians and so on as we go along, which I'll highlight in red. But I want to be talking about diffeomorphism covariant Lagrangians, Lagrangians that have, you know, a symmetry under coordinate transformations, or more said much better than that, there's no background structure in the Lagrangian, well, apart from manifold structure or whatever, but all of the fields that appear in the Lagrangian are dynamical. If that's the case, it'll automatically be true that if you make a little infinitesimal diffeomorphism on the fields of interest, the Lagrangian is going to change by that infinitesimal diffeomorphism. This symbol is Lie derivative, but all I mean by that is how the thing changes if you move it infinitesimally along this vector field X that I've introduced, which is an arbitrary vector field, and it's extremely important that all this hold for arbitrary vector fields. So in this context, in fact, then you could re-express the Lagrangian as a function of, well, I'm assuming that it's a function of the metric and other tensor fields. I mean, this can be generalized, but I won't talk about this here. I mean, gauge fields don't really nicely fit into this formalism, because applying a diffeo to a gauge field without a gauge transformation doesn't, you know, you really should be including all of the local symmetries together, including the gauge transformations, and also spinner fields, you really should introduce tetrads rather than the metric, and then you also have, you know, gauge associated with that. That can be taken into account, but I'm not going to discuss that here. I'm going to assume that the dynamical fields are the metric and some arbitrary collection of tensor fields. Okay, usually people write down Lagrangians as scalar densities, you know, with square roots of minus g times some scalar function. The first very minor comment is that I think it's actually a lot simpler to view the Lagrangian as an n-form, something ready to be integrated over your n-dimensional space-time, rather than a scalar density, mainly because it's a lot easier, I think, to use Stokes' theorem than Gauss's law and have to worry about volume elements and their various, well, Lie derivative identities involving forms that are then very easy to apply. But this is a completely minor point that's much more of a matter of taste. So to get you oriented in that, the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian then, instead of writing that as square root of minus g times r, I'm writing it as R times the volume form, where this is the metrically determined, this is a, depends on the metric, it's the metrically determined volume form that, that appears here. Okay, my second piece of advice, or whatever on there is, or tip, or whatever is, people then almost always put this Lagrangian under an integral sign and pretend they're integrating it over space-time and obtaining an action. Well, I mean, the problem with that, of course, if you're integrating it over all space-time, the integral won't converge, so then you would tend to put a boundary on there, but then you don't get the Euler-Lagrange equations with the boundary, you'll get boundary terms coming in, we'll be talking about that in a second. And then there's a lot of effort to be spent on what boundary term do you need to cancel off the integration by parts term you get varying the action. We will be focusing a tremendous amount on those boundary terms. Those are going to play the whole role. But it, that's a bad way, I would claim, to introduce it, because then you start introducing non-covariant structure into the theory. The boundary is not covariant. The boundary term, thereby, in that sense at least, is not covariant. And it's much easier to not put this under an integral sign and now just consider the variation of the Lagrangian. So if we consider how the, if we just ask how does the Lagrangian change when we do some arbitrary field variation, well, if it was under an integral sign, we'd pick up the way people would do the calculation, we would pick up various terms with derivatives of the varied metric, and then the usual thing people would do would be integrate by parts and get the derivatives off of the varied fields, and write the thing then, well, sort of throw away the boundary term and write the thing as some quantity dotted into the fields. Of course, under, if this were under an integral sign, we'd have the integral sign dotted into the very field, and that is the definition of the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion. Okay, well, I don't want to throw away the boundary term, as I'll emphasize some more. What the boundary term that you'd get if this were under an integral sign would be a total divergence if we were doing this as a scalar density. It's an exact form, an exact n minus 1 form, the d of an n minus 1 form, doing it this way, and the claim is there is, you can always write the varied Lagrangian in this form, where the, well, the E is unique and the theta will be unique up to adding an exact form of its own. So usually, then, people throw away this boundary term, or maybe they've already done some work to put in a boundary term that cancels that, and now you focus attention on the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion, which, however, since, at least for general relativity, we've all memorized that, we really didn't have to bother doing this. But for everything that I'm going to say in this talk, what I'm not the least bit interested in the form of E. That, I knew that anyway, but that's there's no information of use to be gained from that. The interesting quantity here is this boundary term theta that arises. And I should emphasize, I'm doing this for general relativity in these, in this example, but here we're completely general. I mean, we're in this completely general context of metric and arbitrary tensor fields and arbitrary Lagrangian that's a function of those things, those objects and their derivatives. Okay, so again, to get you oriented, the theta would be an n minus 1 form, and if you compute it for the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian in general relativity, this is what you get. Okay, well, what this theta, the main thing this theta is immediately useful for, although you're going to see it popping up in many other places as well, is the computation of this so-called symplectic current. Well, again, because I'm doing things in form ways, instead of this being a current density, it's an n minus 1 form. Oops, but this object is obtained by taking an anti-symmetrized variation of the theta. The theta depends on a variation of, on the background metric and its variation. If there were other fields, it would depend on those too. What I can now do is do an independent variation. So this might be delta 1 of phi, and I can do a second variation, delta 2 of phi. And the if I do those variations and anti-symmetrize over 1 and 2, then it's actually very easy to see that the resulting object is going to be conserved if these objects satisfy the linearized equations of motion. I mean, although I haven't written out the proofs of most of the things I'm writing down, they're all essentially one or two lines. I mean, if you take a variation, a second variation of this, when you anti-symmetrize on the Lagrangian, you'll get zero because that's just a function. So this will effectively give you the symplectic form, and if the linearized equations of motion hold, that this term won't contribute, and that gives you a conservation. Now, conserved things are really nice and they're very important. This isn't used in daily life, at least in classical relativity, that much directly. We'll see that it is used quite a bit indirectly, because this depends on two perturbations. So having a conserved quantity that depends on two perturbations is generally not as nice as having a conserved quantity for one perturbation, though you'll see that we'll get that as well. So the phase space structure then is really obtained by, well, defining a suitable symplectic form that you get by integrating this symplectic current over a Cauchy surface. And if you go through the calculations again, as just as an example, using the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, you get this symplectic form, sort of inner product. I mean, it's not positive, of course, between two perturbations would be given by this form, this expression, where this P of the so-called canonical momentum is related to the extrinsic curvature of the Cauchy surface that we're talking about. And it's not an accident that this P is the canonical momentum, because that's how the canonical momentum was defined in the first place. It was defined to be this way in order that it would be the quantity that would make this formula hold. Okay. So one thing you can try to do when you have a Lagrangian is get a Hamiltonian and get Hamilton's equations of motion. Now, what Hamiltonians are really, I mean, if you're trying to figure out what the equations of motion are and somebody's given you a Hamiltonian, that's really good, because then you can figure out what the equations of motion are. But again, we know the equations of motion. The writing it in Hamiltonian form is not very helpful, particularly for, for some purposes it is useful, but anyway, that's not my point here in writing out Hamilton's equations of motion. So if we have been given a Hamiltonian, and now you see the subscript X here, because I'm looking at Hamiltonians. Hamiltonians are supposed to be generating the time evolution in space-time, but time in space-time could be anything, and in fact it's useful to generalize this even when one has a metric around, so the vector fields look different. Time-like and space-like and so on are very different vector fields. There's no reason to restrict this X to be a time translation, a time-like vector field, and interpret it as a time translation. We could also consider this to be a rotation, or consider this to be a general vector field. Of course, for a general vector field, you won't have a Hamiltonian. We'll get into that in a minute. But anyway, that I'm explaining my subscript X. So this is the Hamiltonian conjugate to the notion of, quote, time translation that is associated with the vector field X. So if you know the Hamiltonian, you've already figured out what P and Q are by going through the calculations that I indicated with general relativity, and now what you want to know is what are the equations of motion? Well, these are Hamilton's equations of motion. I mean, H would be called a Hamiltonian if and only if these are the equations of motion. And that's the usual form that you'd write the Hamilton equations of motion. Well, I'm going to show you what I consider to be a tremendously more useful form of Hamilton's equations of motion when you're in the situation, which is the situation I'm concerned with. You know the equations of motion. That's not the issue or the problem. But you haven't perhaps done the work of breaking up phase space into a P and Q. And you're trying to figure out whether a Hamiltonian exists, and if so, what it is. Then I claim this is a tremendously more useful form of Hamilton's equations of motion. So maybe take a second to see what I'm saying this is. So what I'm saying is, if we consider H would be a Hamiltonian, so H depends on the dynamical fields and this vector field that it's conjugate to. And H would be said to be a Hamiltonian if, when I vary it with an arbitrary field variation, the resulting thing is the symplectic product of the varied fields with the way phi, the background field phi, changes under this infinitesimal time translation. So this equation is supposed to hold if and only if the equations of motion hold. In other words, satisfying this equation, H will be a Hamiltonian if satisfying this equation is equivalent to the equations of motion. So now what does that have to do with what usual form of Hamilton's equations of motion? Because it is kind of disguised. But if you imagine sort of dividing by delta phi to take a functional derivative, use the fact that this is a, you know, dp wedge dq kind of thing, you know, it has that anti-symmetrized form in delta p and delta q, then taking that into account, the functional derivative with respect to phi will turn into the, you know, delta p's and delta q's with the appropriate minus sign. These functional derivatives with the appropriate minus sign with respect to P and Q. And this equation is then, you know, when you've solved for Li x of phi, that's what you'll get. But here, again, I think I'm stating that this is equivalent to the usual form of Hamilton's equations of motion, but I think it's a much more useful way of writing it if you already knew the equations of motion and you're not trying to figure out what they are. Okay, there's one more ingredient in this, and then we'll have all the machinery we need for me to show you what I want to show you, which is the notion of another current and also another charge. So I already defined diffeomorphism covariance, and it just means that if we vary the field by an infinitesimal diffeomorphism, the Lagrangian n-form changes by an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. But that immediately implies that if I define this new quantity J, the another current, to be this same theta that appears all over the place here, where I stick in for the varied field this the way it varies under the local symmetry, the infinitesimal diffeomorphism, and then I subtract off x, the vector field, dotted into the Lagrangian, so this gives me an n minus 1 form. This thing will be conserved, that is, in the forms language, it'll be closed whenever the equations of motion hold. That's if we just take d of this, we'll get the d theta, and the d of this, we can use a Lie derivative identity, and this stuff to relate that to delta L, and the d theta appears here, and if you just go back to the, you know, to this equation, you immediately see that the another current is conserved, so there's nothing particularly behind that. Okay, a fact that takes a little bit more work to show is this is conserved, but the X is totally arbitrary in here. It's conserved no matter what X is, well, at least when the equations of motion hold. And one can show that that implies that this thing has to take the form of X with no derivatives on it, dotted into something that automatically vanishes when the equations of motion hold, plus an exact form. And this is another exact form that's locally constructed out of the dynamical fields phi and the vector field X. Furthermore, this C will automatically satisfy a sort of Bianchi identity, and it's really appropriate to use the word constraints to say what, well, to characterize this C. In any case, in general relativity, these are the usual Hamiltonian and momentum constraints. I mean, Hamiltonian constraint if you take this to be the normal to your surface, and momentum constraints if this is tangential. This QX is called the another charge, and again, explicitly in the case of general relativity, it's just the anti-symmetrized derivative of the vector field, you know, dualized with this epsilon. Okay, so now to really the heart of the matter, because we can figure out, well, if a Hamiltonian exists, what it has to be. And that's from a fundamental variational identity that takes, I didn't write it out, but it takes exactly two lines to derive. That identity is obtained by taking these two different expressions for the Noether current, taking a first order variation of them, so varying the, I should have had a phi in here, not a g, the, all of the dynamical fields, taking a first order variation of the Noether current and equating the two expressions. So I'm going to get a delta L. I can use the Euler-Lagrange variation there, and I get a delta theta with the Li X of G, and that's equated to something which has varied constraints and varied Noether charge. If you collect the terms and you also use, well, appropriate Li derivative type identities, you can reassemble the variation of the theta with respect with the one of the variations being Li X of G with, you know, the varied L gives you a theta term and so on. Anyway, you can reassemble it, the theta terms, most of them at least, into this symplectic current, which is giving you the symplectic current product between your variation and a local symmetry. And then you get terms with equations of motion, varied constraints, and you get an exact term coming in. But Hamilton's equations of motion is exactly what involves the integral of the left side. So if you integrate over a Cauchy surface, what you find is that a Hamiltonian will exist for this vector field X. Well, if it exists, then the varied Hamiltonian has to be of this form. So there's no problem with a Hamiltonian existing as far as this is concerned. You can just pull the delta outside, and that shows the Hamiltonian is always a pure constraint volume term, and then there's a boundary term. And this term, you can pull the delta outside as well. This one, you can't, and it'll depend on, in general, it'll depend on what X is. X will have to be some suitable asymptotic symmetry in order to get a Hamiltonian. But this shows that for any theory, any diffeomorphism covariant theory, the Hamiltonian, if it exists, is always a, well, on shell, is always this pure surface term. So if we have an asymptotically flat spacetime, then this surface term defines the ADM quantities, depending on whatever X is. If X is an asymptotic time translation, this is the ADM mass. If X is an asymptotic rotation, this is the ADM angular momentum, etc. 5 minutes. Okay, great. That's exactly what I'll need. Okay, so what does this all have to do with black holes and something? So far, nothing, but we're only a short step away, because now that I've established these formulas, let's consider a stationary black hole, and let's take X to be the horizon killing field, which at infinity will be some linear combination of time translations and rotations. And let's plug that in to this formula. Well, the X is a killing field, so this term is zero. I'm assuming equations of motion hold, so this term is zero. I'm assuming the perturbation satisfies the constraints, so this term is zero. And all I get is this boundary term, which if I now integrate over a Cauchy surface that now goes to infinity and to the horizon, I just pick up the boundary terms. So the boundary terms at infinity are just giving me the ADM, the varied ADM conserved quantities. So I pick up these terms from infinity, and if you go to the horizon of the black hole, X is zero for the horizon killing field, so you just pick up the varied nether charge. And now it's a further computation. This is a computation that takes a little bit of work, but again, using the fact that this boundary is the bifurcation surface of a killing horizon, you can show that the varied nether charge is the surface gravity of the horizon times the variation of this quantity, which is just something that you construct from the Lagrangian. I mean, basically varying the Lagrangian, imagining that the Riemann curvature was some independent quantity and varying it. So this S, since this takes the form of first law of black hole mechanics, this S can be identified with the entropy of a black hole. Well, you need more than that. This kappa is over 2 pi is the Hawking temperature. There's definitely more to be said, but this is a key part of it. Okay, but that the story doesn't end there. I mean, there's more to tell, which I'll just briefly mention. I have, I hope, another minute or two left, but this is just 2 more slides total, and this won't take much time. So one can define, using this symplectic structure, a notion of canonical energy of a perturbation. If you're perturbing off of a stationary background, well, in this case, I'm using the horizon killing field, but it doesn't matter, at least for this. You can define a canonical energy conjugate to K for a single perturbation by taking the symplectic product of the perturbation and its Lee K. Now, if you look at this in more detail, you actually have to impose some gauge conditions to make this gauge invariant and so on. But with more work that I'm not going to go into and restricting now to general relativity specifically, one can show that for axisymmetric perturbations at least, this EK has a positive flux and through both infinity and the black hole horizon. And by, well, a little bit of further argument, it follows that positivity of this canonical energy with for perturbations that fix the mass and angular momentum is both necessary and sufficient for linear dynamic stability. So this is a criteria for the stability of black holes. It also would apply to black brains. Well, remarkably, though, if we go back to this fundamental identity, if I take now a second order variation of this, well, you can kind of see that I'll only the delta, the next order variation can only hit this delta here because this is zero in the background because of the killing field. And what you'll get is a formula for the canonical energy that relates the canonical energy to second order variations of precisely the quantities that appear in the first law of black hole mechanics. And what this shows is that, in fact, the positivity of canonical energy is also necessary and sufficient for local thermodynamic stability, that is, a maximum of entropy at fixed mass and angular momentum. So for black holes, at least in general relativity, again, the Lagrangian formulation is playing a central role to show that dynamic and thermodynamic stability are equivalent. So my conclusion is, it's in terms of the 3 things in my title, this black holes, thermodynamics, and Lagrangians, it's been well, not necessarily understood, but well noted for over 40 years that there is a very deep connection between black holes and thermodynamics. And it's clear that the Lagrangian structure of general relativity is playing a very deep and central role in this relationship. Thank you. Yeah, no, that's a huge misunderstanding in terms of what, not by you, but I mean, stars in, also in Newtonian gravity have negative heat capacity and, but lots of them are stable. Okay, so if you're talking about a finite system, the correct criteria for thermodynamic stability is that the entropy should be a maximum at fixed values of the state parameters. And the relevant state parameters here are mass and angular momentum. There might be if we had a matter, charged matter or something, charges, and long range, gauge fields, et cetera, there'd be charges in the mix in state parameters. But more generally, if we're doing stars, it would similarly be entropy should be a maximum at fixed mass, angular momentum, and particle number, if we have a conserved particle number. Okay, if you go to an infinite system, though, then there's no reason to, you don't have to restrict to fixing these sort of state parameters. Well, things like energy or whatever, would have to be replaced by energy per volume or something of that sort if we were considering an infinite system. But in the infinite system case, you can take energy from one place and put it somewhere else, conserving the total energy. But the second order variation doesn't care about the sign of your perturbation. So, if you can decrease the entropy to second order, changing the energy, then you're in trouble, because then you could decrease it to second order with a long wavelength perturbation without doing that. So for that reason, if you had a homogeneous infinite system, negative heat capacity would imply thermodynamic instability. And that's what people should be saying when they say it's unstable. But if you have a finite system, there's no such result. So the Schwarzschild black holes, by the definition I'm giving of thermodynamic stability, are perfectly thermodynamically stable because you can't decrease their area with a perturbation that keeps the mass fixed. On the other hand, a Schwarzschild black string is a homogeneous system, and the negative heat capacity of the Schwarzschild black string implies that that's thermodynamically and therefore by this result dynamically unstable. So the trivial calculation of the heat capacity of a Schwarzschild black hole and finding that that's negative is sufficient to prove that the Schwarzschild black string is dynamically unstable to long wavelength perturbations. Well, there's more that has to be done in the GR case because we have to satisfy the constraints and show that that in satisfying the constraints, we don't change the canonical energy a lot, and so on. So it's not a totally trivial thing, but the basic argument is that.
I always think that the reason that we have Lagrangians in classical physics is that actions are needed to formulate quantum mechanics in the mode of Feynman, so that these properties, for example, the surface terms, are necessary in order that the action be additive on regions. Of course, quantum mechanics is also essential for the thermodynamic properties of the black hole, right, through the Hawking effect. Do you see any connection here? Is such as quantum mechanics being restated?
No, I guess I don't. But I don't. But if you ask me even for a reason why Lagrangians are coming into this and you can get thermodynamic stuff out of Lagrangians, it mystifies me completely in the first place. I mean, even working through all the formalism, I still don't really understand why magically using the Lagrangian formalism things come out.
Thanks.
And I mean, I'm not denying that it may be very relevant to consider actions, and the actions may well be more fundamental than Lagrangians, and then of course you do have to worry about these boundary terms and all that. I'm just saying for these calculations, it's really a lot simpler and clearer to not think about them and just work locally without ever only putting on the integrals when you're integrating over Cauchy surfaces and so on, never integrating over space-time.
Thank you.
So, since no one could interview you as a straight there, there are theories that people believe have good quantum mechanical properties but don't come from a Lagrangian, even classically, like the self-dual p-form field. So, does that mean I should worry that the theory doesn't come from Lagrangian, something about black hole thermodynamics gives enough stuff?
Oh, I would, yeah, I would very much worry that something about black hole thermodynamics would get messed up. I mean, I don't see any reason why there would be a first law of black hole mechanics, or, I mean, maybe there would be, but I really see that as coming directly from the Lagrangian structure. So that would be an interesting thing to check whether it still somehow works.
So I was just wondering if you could comment on those non-axisymmetric modes. First of all, I'm curious, what is it that makes them hard to work with in terms of showing that there is the flux of energy,
yeah,
just not positive, and what does that mean? And also, can you help me process, you said at the end that there is this equivalence between stability and thermodynamic stability, but there was a caveat about the non-axisymmetric mode. So is that a caveat on the equivalence, or?
No, I mean the, good question. So the fundamental problem, and I don't see any way around this, with treating non-axisymmetric perturbations, which are really the interesting ones for stability, I mean, of curves. I mean, for the static black holes, we can treat axisymmetric ones, that non-axisymmetric ones, I mean. But the fundamental problem is that we need a killing field in this to make anything work. If we choose the time translation killing field, we will automatically get a positive flux at infinity. It'll be basically the Bondi flux. If we choose the horizon killing field, we will get a positive flux through the black hole. So that's all fine. But if we're dealing, and if we deal with axisymmetric perturbations, it's equivalent, almost by definition, either one is equivalent, so we can pretend that we're doing both. And we get a positive flux. But the problem is there's no choice of killing field that will give us a positive flux through both. So therefore, we don't pick up a criteria for dynamic stability. I think thermodynamic stability, we probably ought to, in some sense, is automatically probably violated in that you can, No, I'd have to think about that. But anyway, there's not going to be a connect. The canonical energy cannot be used to analyze dynamic stability. I guess it could still be used to analyze thermodynamic stability. Yeah, okay, the big problem is, everything is thermodynamically, this is what I was trying to remember, everything is thermodynamically unstable when we consider non-axisymmetric modes, because keeping the angular momentum fixed is a big part of this, but if you had a Kerr black hole, what you could do with a non-axisymmetric perturbation is have a tiny amplitude perturbation that's really far away and carries a tremendous amount of angular momentum, and then you can use, you can then spin down the black hole, use that extra energy to increase the area, and so in this sense, all the black holes are thermodynamically unstable, but the criteria is useless for dynamic stability. So I don't see that anything useful can be done. Yeah, so if you wanted to consider the non-superradiant modes, then it probably is, you still have the equivalence, I think. Yeah, that's right.
So usually in the sort of textbook treatments of Lagrangians, they go about saying that, well, you can always add a divergence to the Lagrangian because that doesn't change the equations of motion. But in your system, it seems like you would get something different if you added a divergence. So do you lose the freedom to add a divergence to the Lagrangian?
No.
And if so, how do you choose the right Lagrangian?
No, so you could always add an exact form to the Lagrangian. That would be the dual forms way of doing it. And that will change. I already said you could add an exact form to the theta because that boundary term is also similarly non-unique, and you could always add an exact form to the Noether charge because that's also, by its definition, you know, it's defined in terms of the Noether current with a dq in there, and you could always add, so you just have to see how that changes the formulas. I mean, so most importantly, for the first law of black hole mechanics, those three freedoms turn out to have no effect. But if you're doing something more, if no effect for the formula for black hole entropy, for example, you end up with the same, an equivalent
in
formula.
GR or in any diffeomorphism?
Any diffeomorphism covariant theory.
So is
But if you were doing other things, it might change, some formulas. I mean, we checked it carefully for the black hole, first law of black hole mechanics and formula for black hole entropy. We chased through where everything came in and how the ambiguities affected things, and they end up not. But I'm not claiming that it wouldn't affect anything at all.
So that sounds kind of miraculous. I mean, is there a reason why it works out that way?
It's just stationary black hole.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's just, it's only in this context. Well, I don't know. I mean, the Killing horizons have so many nice and special properties that, you know, just the stuff that would otherwise, I mean, things that, terms that would come in that would be multiplied by this vector field X don't end up entering because X is zero on the bifurcation mm-hmm. surface.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, things like that is, you know, how it works.
Okay, thanks.
We should move on. George, do you have a short question or you want to?
Yeah.
Yes, you can drop the, yes, you, and we still haven't written this up, it's sort of overdue, but I mean, one could thereby prove that any black hole in ADS that has an ergo region, now the ergo region would be defined, you take the horizon Killing field and you ask if that becomes space-like near infinity. So, you know, I'm 99% sure we can prove that any such black hole with an ergo region is unstable by considering these non-axis. Yeah, so the axis symmetry is not needed if you only have one boundary.
We should move on. So thank Bob.